live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by economists Robert Janetsky, Mike Miller, and Mark White. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in downtown Chicago. By the way, that's Mark Witte. I didn't say White. Sorry about that. Our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. Keep in mind that this the audio and video portion of the program is saved on our website. So if you miss it on a Sunday night, you'll be able to listen or watch it for many, many months to come, perhaps many, many years. So the words that are said in the next 2 hours will be remembered forever. Tonight, we are going to try to bring some sense and some definition to the issue that really has dominated American politics for the last several months, and that's the issue of the debt ceiling and the economic crisis that we have in the country and what's going on in Washington, D.C. as we speak. And we have three differing opinions. They will agree on some things. They'll disagree on others, but I'm going to try to make this as simple a discussion as possible because the subject can be very complex. I'd like to begin sort of as a news question. My memory is that every August there is the perfunctory debt ceiling vote, and it happens every year, and it gets about 3 inches of coverage in the newspaper. What makes this year different? Mike Witte of...
He's Mike, I'm Mark.
I'm Mark. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, this year, the Republicans in Congress are taking it very seriously that it's something of a historical anachronism that this thing is there at all. It was sort of put there originally to make it easier for the Treasury to manage the debt. And they sort of said, look, we'll give you some limit, do whatever you want until it comes up that limit, then come back and ask for us. And so, yeah, it's been pretty much always automatic up until this year.
Robert, what's your answer?
Well, the situation has gotten far more serious than it has in the past. Basically, the government has been going on in the course of the past 3 months paying bills in a very unusual way, not funding pensions for retirees and things like that, in order to try and get by with every last dollar they could. And now they're absolutely up against the absolute ceiling, to the point where something and some major items are going to have to be cut if the ceiling is not increased.
Mike, your response.
My response is that one thing that makes this one different is that if we go back to, say, the vote that occurred during the Bush administration, where both the president as a senator, Obama and Biden, they both voted against raising the debt ceiling. But, of course, in that year, the deficit was going to be about 2% of GDP. And in the following year, 2007, I believe the deficit was about 1.8% of GDP. So clearly, by raising it, you were not necessarily encumbering future generations with tons and tons of future debt. But here we are now, it's 10% of GDP, and something that the economy has 9.2% unemployment. So you have one thing saying we have to raise it because we have to be able to fund all the unemployment and try to stimulate the economy. And on the other hand, the Republicans have a very good point to make that we have got to do something about the spending. The spending is out of control. So it is a unique confluence of items coming together.
Now, according to a published report in the Washington Post today, the government took in $7,000 in revenue for every man, woman, and child in the United States. It spent $11,000 per person, obviously leaving a difference of $4,000 per person. That is the deficit, and it has been paid by borrowing that money. A question, historical question. When did we as a nation begin to spend more money than we brought in? Bob?
Well, it depends on when. There was a time as a nation when under President Clinton we actually ran what it was very close to a budget surplus, if not a budget surplus. But it depends on the years that you look at in terms of what the financing was. And even if you're running a budget deficit in any particular year, you should always relate it to the size of the economy to get a better perspective on things. I mean, a $1 billion deficit in, 30, 40, 50 years ago is a heck of a lot different than
if we were to look back in the 1920s,
go back 20s. To the beginning, 1776.
Let's go.
We ran budget deficits every time we needed to because of a national priority. And so, to beat the British, we ran budget deficits.
That's
we
right.
borrowed to fund the Continental Army.
So there's nothing new to it.
No, Hamilton convinced President Washington we had to take the state's debts and put them into one so we could solidify the creditworthiness of the United States. And one thing to keep in mind, we've been here once before. At the end of World War II, the total debt as a percentage of gross domestic product was 125%. But nobody cared because we had just beaten the Nazis. We had just beaten Imperial Japan.
We felt good.
Now, what happened from that point on is that we didn't remain at that very high level because the economy grew faster than the deficits that we had after that.
And spending was cut very significantly. Coming off the war, there was a huge reduction in spending. That's a big difference between what we had then and what we face today, because today we've got underlying spending growth, as you mentioned before, that is just through the roof.
Between Medicare and Social Security and the pensions for workers who have these defined benefit programs, we've got to do something.
I'd say there's two important differences there. One is we're nowhere near where we were at the end of World War II. We're at 70-something percent.
65. I just looked it up this morning.
We're basically half. Yeah. The other was at the end of World War II, we were basically at full employment. There was some concern about what we're going to do with all these people coming back. Right. But it's interesting to think about those percentages, that at the end of World War II, we had this 125% of debt, and we went into basically the best half century of economic growth that anybody's ever seen.
Right.
Before the Great Depression, we were at 16%, and we went into the worst period we've ever seen up till now.
Yeah, you can't make a one-to-one correspondence between the deficit or the debt and the absolute condition of the economy.
All right, one of the big, obviously, political discussion that is going on is the Democrats always like to point to President Clinton. They like to talk about the surplus that he handed to President Bush. Absent the attack on 9/11. Would we be in an entirely different fiscal situation in this country, Bob?
I think we definitely would have. The increase in government spending in the past decade really began after 9/11 with the spectacular increase in the size of the government, transportation, safety, communication, upping the expense for the wars, upping the expense for protection at home and homeland security. Those figures started to increase very dramatically. And I would compare that really to the World War II expenditures. I mean, if the country is under attack in a certain way, one of the prime responsibilities of government is to protect the people. And it really doesn't matter whether you're going to spend 5% or 10% of GDP, whatever you're going to spend. That's
a blank check at that point.
It's the first responsibility of government, and whether you borrow it or tax it, you've got to be protecting people.
You're going to keep in mind the Clinton administration had this end of the Soviet Union advantage.
Peace dividend.
The peace dividend. Exactly right.
By the way, before we get into the peace dividend, because we're going to a break right now, and I want to pick up on that particular point right now. 1-800-723-8029. And if you have any questions about the history of how we got to where we are, or you want to offer your two cents, do give us a call. 1-800-723-8029. We got the experts around the table in Chicago for the next couple of hours. So I hope you'll join with your conversations and your questions when we come back to Chicago. From Boston, Massachusetts to Fresno, California, you are listening to Beyond the Beltway, and we're back on the air in Fresno tonight. So if you're listening to us in Fresno, nice to have you with us. 1-800-723-8289. We're talking about the economy, the debt ceiling, all things economic tonight with three economists. And I want to get everybody's reaction to the battles that have been going on, specifically some of the rhetoric coming from the highest levels of government. What happens if the debt ceiling is not raised by August 2nd, in your opinion, Bob?
Well, I think it's not just my opinion, it's just about everyone's opinion. If the debt ceiling is not raised, there are going to have to be significant immediate cuts in the federal budget. And it is an interesting...
Why?
Because in August, there is a lot more in the way of bills that have to be paid, absolutely have to be paid, if government is going to continue at its current rate, then there is money coming in. We still have a lot of money coming in. The estimate is like $172 billion is coming in tax receipts to the government in August. But the expenditures are something like 300 and something billion, almost 400
billion. Does everybody agree with that at this table?
Mm-hmm. I do.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
I want to, Mark, pick up the discussion. What are the bills that don't get paid? When do we move? I mean, there's people listening to the show that say, you know what? I got a bill that's due in August, but you know what? I don't have the money. I'm not going to pay it. So the government, you know, they'll give you a little, or they'll give you a little bit in August, a little bit in September, and most creditors these days will give you some leeway. What happens to the government in this situation?
It's a sad thing when the U.S. government is acting that way. I mean, I certainly hear from people in the state of Illinois who feel they're, you know, very much in arrears from the state, and, yeah, that the federal government would go that same route, that the precedent under Robert Rubin was essentially the executive figures out what is it they're going to choose to pay, and they're almost surely going to pay the interest on the outstanding debt. President Obama suggested maybe Social Security checks wouldn't go out. It's sort of, throwing it on a little threat.
That's pretty scary.
That's pretty scary. And I mean, it's essentially, there isn't really a precedent for this. I mean, it's a crazy thing.
Soldiers would not get paid?
Well, what happened before was they basically shorted a lot of, you know, defense contractors and people like that. And the odd thing is that the debt limit is a limit on explicit government bonds. That's how many of those can be issued. But you can implicitly borrow. You know, like, basically, you don't pay into the office coffee pool and things like that. And that, you know, essentially the U.S. government would implicitly short a bunch of people with the promise that we're going to sort this thing out and you'll get your money then.
Okay. Mike, pick up the conversation. Then what happens?
They would, if this would continue and they weren't going to come up with some new debt limit, then they're just going to have to cut. They're going to have to say Department of Education, until you hear otherwise, you're furloughed, or Department of Commerce, or whomever, but they're going to have the FBI. There has to be policing powers.
Now, there's a lot of people that are listening to the broadcast this evening. At least the two departments that you just listed, they're cheering by the radio right now. They're saying, "Okay, there's no Department of Education, no Department of Commerce.
There's no." Yeah.
Okay, those people that are cheering, if they get a Social Security check and they're not going to get a Social Security check,
then they're not cheering.
Then they're not cheering.
Right. And keep in mind, these are people to whom we've made a certain promise. You're employed. And if you do your job, we'll do our job and we'll pay you. And all of a sudden you're going to tell these people no? It's so morally bankrupt that the government has no choice. They have got to raise the debt limit. We've made all these promises to pay all these people all this money. We have to do it.
Well,
I
would disagree that the government has to. And the first thing you want to do, let's stick with this spending program, because there is an excellent website. It's called bipartisanpolicy.org, which will allow you to see a good estimate or reasonable estimates of exactly what's coming in terms of tax receipts, and then what parts of the budget the money would be going out for. And you can kind of play what the president has to do or the Treasury is going to have to do.
Armchair,
what do I want to cut? Now, I went through this, and just my own obvious bias preferences. It's easier to say what I included. And what I included is I paid the debt, because to me that would be the interest on the debt would be the most colossal financial problem if we did. I pay Social Security. I paid the military. I paid essential government services such as the FBI and the protection and things like that. Now, what did I not pay? The biggest chunk of what I didn't pay was basically most of the federal government that's non-essential. That is, I mean, people are not going to basically be without a check, other than these government workers.
What is non-essential? Because, again, before we went on the air, you know, frequently, you know, when they refer to, even if it's based on weather, they say only essential government workers mm-hmm. went to work today. Well, so they obviously know who the essential and the non-essential are.
Essential
What's
is
non-essential
if,
for you?
If,
Give
if,
me a
if
non-essential
not, if there's
federal
not,
government.
If there's not life-threatening consequences as a if these people are not there. Now, the air traffic controllers, yes, you have to pay them. You're not going to have aviation come to
How
a stop.
How about federal prison guards?
Yes, yes. You can't have the federal prison guards go home. No.
What you're saying makes perfect sense with only one caveat. As long as you would do this over time and make a nice, orderly transition into a smaller government, I have no problem with that. But to make some kind of statement, we don't have to raise the debt, and we can tomorrow cut all this, is nonsense.
That's an excellent point, because that's why this whole thing is coming about now. Let's look at what we all agree to. And by all, I mean Republicans, Democrats, I mean President Obama. What do they all agree to? They all agree that spending is out of control, that deficits are out of control for the future. Now, why do I say they all agree with that? Well, the president complied with law in January, early February, issued his budget as he was supposed to. That budget went to the Senate. The Senate rejected it 97-0.
Yes, that's right.
And said, this is the most irresponsible budget. We cannot approve of it. Not one senator in either party approved it. Came back to the president. The president said, you know, you're right. This is a totally irresponsible budget. Now, neither he nor the Senate has done the responsible thing. The Senate has just basically broken the law, and they've done it for 3 years, have not come up with an alternative. They all agree it's running out of control. So the House is the only body of our government that has complied with the law, and they said, hey, this is our budget. Now let's debate
Mark,
it.
Mark.
Well, to change the subject from political theater to economics, their budget,
they're very
budget ceiling is going to go up.
They're very closely related.
If we screw it up, yes. Yeah, in theater, you hit somebody with a sword hard enough and you actually killed them, but, you know, that's not the...
We've screwed it up because both the president and the Senate have refused to come up with a detailed budget, which is what they're all supposed to do for the future, a detailed budget that basically puts us on this course that Mike talked about, which is basically a course that's not going to head us into
all this
bank.
Stuff. Is,
you, by the way, you mentioned, you know, the Senate being irresponsible, the House is responding. You know, the founding fathers had a reason why members of the lower house or the House of Representatives have to go to the polls, every 2 years as opposed to every 6 years. They wanted the House to be closer to the pulse of the American people. The American people appear to be demanding that they want to cut spending.
Yes, that's right. And the founders gave the power of the purse to the House. All tax bills must emanate from Ways and Means, from the House of Representatives. That's where the true power lies.
So that's where the overspending began.
Exactly right.
The people asked for it.
That's when you think of the Bush deficits, or you talk about the Clinton surpluses. These are really congressional actions, and the president simply signs them because the power of the purse resides with the House.
And it is also in a political context. When Democrats point to Bush for breaking his promise, or, you know, they make the point, you know, that Bush inherited a surplus, mm-hmm. they don't draw the link between the attack on 9/11.
No, they don't.
And
a recession.
And what Bush said in that campaign, you will remember, I mean, he said he opposed nation building. Well, when he said that, he didn't think that he was going to have to get involved the way he's gotten involved.
Several things, somebody can
debate whether he's gotten too involved, but again, at least insofar as the initial, you know, call to war, there were a lot of Democratic votes that went up on that as well.
I think you give the president too little credit. I mean, a lot of these initiatives really do stem from
initiatives, yes.
But without George Herbert Walker Bush pushing for a tax increase, it wouldn't have happened. Without Clinton pushing for tax increases, it wouldn't have happened.
That's true.
Without Bush pushing for tax cuts and Medicare Plan D, none of that would have happened.
I guess.
And the tax cuts and Medicare Plan D, that was discretionary. Those were enormous.
Yeah.
And that's really where the debt problem comes from.
Is that the biggest mistake?
I think that's totally wrong.
I want to get your response. is the decision on medical expenses for seniors, is that the biggest mistake that George Bush made fiscally? And Congress. It wasn't just Bush.
No, I think the overlarge tax cuts.
Oh. And, I don't know. And I think, well, that's ridiculous. All you have to do is look at the evidence. From every time this nation has raised taxes significantly, it has reduced economic activity, reduced revenue coming into the government, and whenever they've cut taxes. Now, there's been
Was expanding the prescription drug plan, was that a mistake?
Yes. Yeah, I criticized President Bush at the time for making that mistake.
And everybody agrees with that.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I mean, there were good reasons for it, but it was done wrong.
But keep it – and when Bush became president, I remember discussing in my classrooms – what is the Fed going to do when the national debt disappears? Because in the next 10 years, the national debt is going to be gone based upon the projections of revenues versus spending coming in. And then all of that changed. But something you mentioned about these very generous tax cuts under Bush. Keep in mind that 2007, right before the onset of the Great Recession, the budget deficit was 1.8% of GDP with the current tax rates in place. The current tax rates can generate the needed revenue to run this government if people have jobs.
Yeah, absolutely.
Economic growth is the ultimate thing we have.
Absolutely. And we're on trend for more spending.
We're going to continue this conversation, and the boards are all lit up. So we're going to be taking the calls from the folks coast to coast and border to border. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight on Beyond the Beltway. From Bangor, Maine to Sikeston, Missouri, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Nice to have you with us. Around the table this evening, we have three economists. We have Michael Miller. He is a PhD from DePaul University, from Pittsburgh initially, graduated from University of Pittsburgh, and also a Slippery Rock. So
Slippery Rock State College.
We know where Slippery Rock was.
Yeah.
There was once a great broadcaster in Chicago. He was the longtime voice of the Chicago White Sox. His name was the late, great Bob Elson. He always used to talk about Slippery Rock, Pennsylvania, and I drove through there once on my heading to northeastern Ohio, where we do the show periodically.
I was one of three econ majors.
Oh, really?
We all went to graduate school, so we were well-trained. Yeah.
Anyway, people listening on WKBN in Youngstown, Ohio, certainly know where Slippery Rock College is. Also joining us this evening is Bob Janetsky. He is author of the book Classical Economic Principles and the Wealth of Nations. And I understand that in your teaching career, again, you are a graduate of NYU. You also taught at the University of Chicago. But I understand that two of your former students are now in high positions of economic policymaking. Can you share with the audience who those folks are?
I don't know who you're talking about, Bruce.
A friend of mine said that you had people in very high positions of economic policymaking.
People that I've worked with in the past and and some students as well.
Do they still return your call?
Oh, yes.
Also joining us this evening is Mark Witte. He is a distinguished senior lecturer in economics, PhD from Northwestern University, and born and raised in St. Louis, Missouri. We have lots of callers on the line, folks. We cannot monopolize the conversation. Let's go to Roselle, Illinois, where Brian is listening to us on WLS.
Hey, good evening, Bruce and panelists. I think part of this whole problem is an outgrowth of very flawed policies. I mean, we've just lived through a financial catastrophe, which was a flawed bank deregulation policy. And now we're living through this flawed international globalist free trade policy where we're just shifting American jobs and corporations overseas and then importing the products back so the people on Wall Street can make the most amount of money possible. You know, we were talking about World War II and how that, you know, we repaid our debt after that war and it was no big deal, but people seem to forget that we were the only economy left standing at the end of World War II, and that's how we did it. And then, you know, it really galls me. I have an uncle that was killed fighting the communist Chinese in North Korea in the 50s. And, you know, think about how many billions of dollars are we spending defending against the communist Chinese with conventional warfare, Navy deployment, cyber warfare technology. We're spending all that money defending against the communist Chinese. But on the other hand, we turn and say, hey, Walmart, hey, American manufacturers, just ship your factories over there. No big deal. It'll be great for everybody. It makes no sense whatsoever. and right. the average guy is getting crushed. And people are waking up to that fact. And the people in Washington got to quit prostituting themselves to Wall Street. That is the problem.
All right, let's let all of our guests respond, and we'll start with Mark Witte. Mark, your assessment of our caller.
Well, the average American buys a lot of Chinese stuff. I mean, I think we're all wearing clothes, and I suspect a lot of it came from Asia. And why do we buy it? Because it's a very good bargain. And, you know, we sell things to the Chinese. We sell things to the Koreans. We buy from them. And you know, if we would hope to have good relations with them, and the best good relations with them is through business.
Bob?
Well, I sense another statement that he made, and he made a lot of them, but one of them was regarding the Wall Street is at fault for the financial crisis. Remember, the housing speculators were also blamed. A lot of people have been blamed. We've had a lot of financial crises in the past, and the cause of this one, in my judgment, is exactly the same as the previous ones. Namely, the main cause was because of government. We had some terrible government policies, some big mistakes by the Federal Reserve. For the first time in many years, they actually took money out of the economy, the raw ingredients out, for 3 years, which I believe led to the collapse. And the other thing they did is they made a decision regarding Fannie and Freddie, the value of their bonds, which basically took $20 billion out of the banking system at the beginning of September and led to an immediate collapse in a number of firms. The government is where the power is. The government, when it makes a mistake, creates serious problems. And it's very nice to be blaming Wall Street and bankers and housing speculators and everyone else, but it's the government that usually sets up the conditions that create those sort of actions.
But some would be talking back to the radio and they would say, but many of the people who are on Wall Street, they buy the politicians or they rent the politicians. And the politicians give them the programs and the policies that they want. And so if those policies then come back, and again, they're erroneous policies, the government, the big bad government, is easy to put a finger on. But the reality is, if that government is being funded by corrupt or greedy forces, then we also have a problem, do we not?
The question is whether the people at the Federal Reserve who made the mistake are corrupt and greedy. I don't think they are. I just think that they made mistakes. Mistakes get made. And when you've put a lot of power in the hands of government and they make mistakes, you get big problems.
Mike Miller.
He addressed a lot of topics. So, for example, the financial problems. This was a financial recession. And historically, the worst recessions are always financial recessions. So the fact that this one was the deepest, the longest, the most painful we've had since the Great Depression was not a surprise, given the financial roots of this particular problem. Now, addressing international trade, as an economist, I always there's a hypothesis. Is trade good or bad? And we study all the data. And I think it's clear across the board that economies which trade with other countries, trade freely, let things come across borders, they grow faster. There's no doubt to that. I don't think there's any economist, regardless of their political stripe, that would discount that statement. So the idea of somehow if we could close the borders and not trade with China or whomever, it's not going to help. It's going to hurt. It doesn't raise employment. It keeps it the same or causes it to go down.
But is there at this moment in time, is there something that Congress should be doing, Mark, that would rekindle the likelihood of jobs returning to certain areas of, let's say, urban America? And do we have a situation that politicians just don't have the gumption or the gonads to tell the people what they really need to hear come election time? Is that part of our big problem here? Is we're being spoon-fed, you know, sugary medicine when that's it's killing us?
Well, I'd be reluctant to see politicians trying to decide where jobs should go. I'd be much keener to see things that would encourage general demand. And so, you know, things like tax cuts and government spending increases can help with that. And encouraging trade, actually, that, you know, that seeing, it, say, a depreciating U.S. dollar, seeing, you know, reduced trade barriers, things like that, anything that makes it easier for Americans to produce things and sell them, not only here but in the rest of the world, would be a good thing.
Some people may be hearing what you say is that if you're increasing trade, mm-hmm. you're increasing the manufacturing of products, maybe good quality, bad quality products, but someone else around the world is making that product And so the person who in the United States, North Carolina, South Carolina, southwest side of Chicago, that used to manufacture that product, they are now out of work. So what do they do if they don't have the money to buy the product, albeit a lesser costing product, when they walk into their local Walmart?
Well, American,
where do they go? Because they're the ones that we hear from on talk radio. They're the ones that have fallen through the cracks.
Well, you can lose your job to all sorts of people. I mean, you know, Ford loses jobs to GM. Coke loses jobs to Pepsi. I mean, it's not just, you know, foreigners you're in competition with. That we're in competition with everybody. And so, you know, Americans, we've always been hustling people. We've always been scrapping, trying to find a better way. And, yeah, that foreign competition's tough. American competition's even tougher. And, yeah, it's tough when you lose a job, and you have to get inventive and, you know, reinvent yourself and, you know, use your skills.
Bob?
Yeah, Mark said something that I would vehemently disagree with, because he mentioned at one point that government spending can somehow help to create demand or create more jobs. And it's my judgment that the reason we are in this budget deficit ceiling problem right now is because government spending has increased by too much. Basically, when government spend, there are two different theories on this, and I understand that. One of the theories that I think is dead wrong is that when the government spends money, it somehow creates jobs and adds to the economy. I believe that the government, when it spends money, can do so in only one of two ways. Either they tax it away from someone else, in which case the other person can't spend it, or they borrow it away from someone else. And if they borrow the money from someone else, that other person can't spend the money. You can't spend the same money twice. It's a basic flaw in what's called the Keynesian theory. And it's what's led to this whole argument over the debt ceiling and everything else. The House Republicans are basically frustrated because of the fact that they see the economy has been weakened by all these increases in government spending. They want to bring it to a halt because they want to prevent a future bankruptcy. And my judgment is that if we slow down the growth of government significantly, and if we slow down the compliance expenditures the government has put on business, which are absolutely phenomenal, you would see an explosive rise in job creation, and you wouldn't have these people complaining, well, I lost my job because of the Chinese. You lost it because of policy mistakes right here in this country, and that's the only place it's going to be corrected.
I think there's little evidence to support that. I mean, what is a country that has austerity its way into health?
That austerity is way to help.
I mean, last night I was out by the Evanston Lakeshore, and this beautiful pond that was built in the 1933 by the WPA. And it was Americans in the 1930s that had skills but had no jobs. The government went around and said, okay, build us a duck pond. We're still enjoying that, and those Americans got jobs. They went out and they were able to buy groceries and things like that.
By 1939, the unemployment rate was still 19% with all those government jobs. Now take the opposite. Take the 1920s.
Hang on. We're going to take the 1920s after we take 3 minutes for commercials. 1-800-723-8289. Again, we've got lots of callers. We'll go back to those as well. From Baton Rouge, Louisiana, to Boise, Idaho, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. During the commercial breaks, by the way, these guys are agreeing on nothing. I think you're disagreeing on the air. You should be here for the commercial breaks. Let's go to Boise, Idaho. We just mentioned it. KBOI is the place. And Don, you're the caller. Go ahead. Nice to hear from you tonight.
Yes. What would happen if we were to eliminate the Medicare Part C and D as well as the Obamacare? Also, maybe we eliminated the Dobb-Frank Act, reinstated the Glass-Steagall Act, as well as maybe the Bush tax cuts so that everybody could suffer, possibly the rich could give up their day in the Riviera, the poor could give up a meal a week. I'd like to hear your answer.
Okay, well, let's talk about these Pollyanna ideas, but again, that's what you've got to think about when if we put everything on the table and everything is on the table. What would happen?
That's quite a stew. One thing, there's no doubt that the most pressing spending issue over the next 25 or 30 years is Medicare. We've got to do something about Medicare. We're in a demographic transition that is going to bankrupt the country unless we do something about it. So if you're going to do Schedule C or whatever they're called, that's fine. But you're going to have to do something. We're going to have to tell Grandma you may not be able to have this some kind of procedure because you're 90 years old and we just can't afford it.
We will not pay for it.
We will not pay for it. You can use your own money.
Well, I have been, on medication that I'm on, I've been told I can't take the medication anymore. They will not pay for it.
But will you pay for it? Yeah. See, I take it for my eyes.
Well, I can pay for it now, but I may not, 10 years from now, maybe I can't afford it.
Well, there is another alternative. The question is, what would Medicare what would medical care cost under a free market system versus under a system where the government is controlling everything? Mm-hmm. And I had an interesting experience not so long ago when I was in Mexico and I needed some medical care, didn't have any insurance down there. Well, interestingly enough, what I found out was there are two systems down there. One is a government control system, which I was warned not to go to, because it's inefficient and you might not get good service. But the other was a completely free market system. And what I found out, to make a long story short, is that the prices under the free market system, which are comparable in the area of Mexico I was in to what they are here in Chicago, the prices for medical care were on average about half of what you would pay here.
Yeah, but still,
and that's
Mexico.
Without insurance.
And what's great in Mexico is the price of a sausage is one-fifth what it is here.
No, what I said Mexico. Is the dinners that we went to there and the stores had the similar prices to what we have here.
Let us go to Daniel in Redding, California, listening to us on KQMS. Go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hello.
One of the things I always watch when they develop these budgets is nobody talks a lot about what happened with the previous appropriations and the non-appropriation spending and all the hidden spending that they have in there. I think if they got back and started examining some of that, they might be able to build more intelligent with the way they put a budget together.
Well, again, I don't think there's anybody, at least Bob is suggesting, I don't think anyone in Washington is suggesting that there can't be some cuts. It's the issue of where you begin the cuts and whether or not cuts alone would be able to resolve this current circumstance. Most people don't think that cuts alone will do it. Republicans are the closest, group that thinks you can do it with just cuts.
Do you think we could just do it with cuts?
No. I think there'd be a great deal of damage. You just told the entire federal government to take off, which is incidentally what I did when I went through that procedure. That's a very damaging thing. No one wants to do that. I mean, people have, as Mark mentioned earlier, people were told that they had a job, they had an agreement, they have to show up. You don't want to do it. The reason it's done is because the Senate and the President have both admitted we're headed toward bankruptcy under the current trajectory. They don't like it, but they refuse to come up with a budget that people can look at with particular items.
But they have
to look at it on
each particular line item. You know, when you were listing
total, the OMB and the CBO have scored all this stuff out. I mean, this complaint about the budget is just political theater.
They have not scored the budget because the Senate has not submitted one,
they've scored every part of it.
But Bob,
the president's budget.
Bob, when you were listing the things that you got rid of, I said, I talked about prison guards, and you said, no, you got to keep prison guards.
Sure.
You have to keep the prison guards at the current level because we have so many people incarcerated, more than any other nation on earth. So if you look at sentencing and sentencing guidelines and ask yourselves, with all the people that are in for first and second offense drug offenses, not that those are, that they shouldn't go in for some time, but maybe they're going in for too long. Mandatory, sentencing on some of these things is bad economic policy. Not only is it bad justice, it's bad economic policy. That affects the number of guards, the number of prisons. I mean, no one is going to take the time to do the fine detail on that because, frankly, those federal unions, they've got a lot of clout, and they just want to keep and all they got to do is scare the public talking about the criminals walking the streets, and everybody has they clutch their chests. They're going
I'm
to
not
going to
argue
arrest.
With them. What you're doing is you're saying that there's a flaw in our government that they've screwed up in another area, namely the legal system and laws. I would agree.
But it would be nice if this were a time to focus and bring more intelligence to the spending. However, like John
Bader, never have it. We never have it.
No, and that's the frustrating part. And on the current trajectory, we're basically bankrupting the nation. So it's a question of, do you draw a line now and say, listen, we've got to get on a different trajectory, or else we're going to basically shut things down in a lot of areas.
Shut it down. Just don't do it around raising the debt limit. I don't understand why you would want to take a chance that we would lower the credit rating in the United States, which would raise the cost of us to finance the debt. This is lunacy. I have no problem with having this debate you want to have. This makes perfect sense. I want to see a change in the trajectory of spending. I'm not one in favor of any kind of increase in tax at the moment. But let's have it inside a different context. This debt limit context.
It's not going to happen.
In the next hour, we just touched on the T word. In the next hour of the show, we're going to talk about taxes. I know that Mark's got some real strong opinions on them, and we're going to hear from Mark Witte and the rest of our guests in the next hour. In this first hour, we've been talking with Mark Miller, Associate Professor of Economics at DePaul University, and Mark Witte, Director of Undergraduate Studies in the Department of Economics at Northwestern University, and Bob Janetsky, author of the book Classical Economic Principles and the Wealth of Nations. We're going to be with you for another full hour on radio, 1-800-723-8289. And if you're watching us on television, see you next week. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway this evening. Tonight featuring commentary by economist Robert Janetsky, author of the book Classical Economic Principles and the Wealth of Nations, Mark Miller, an associate professor of economics at DePaul University, and Mark Witte, director of undergraduate studies in the Department of Economics at Northwestern University. 1-800-723-8289 is the telephone number, 1-800-723-8289. We're trying to bring some sense and some knowledge and some background and historical perspective to the economic conditions of the country at the moment and the battle over the debt ceiling and whether or not we will meet an August 2nd deadline. One thing that has come up over the last week, the Republicans seem to be talking over and over and over again about the importance of a balanced budget amendment, that may be one thing that they absolutely are going to demand. It seems to me that I've heard discussion of a balanced budget amendment by Republicans for about 35 years now in presidential politics. Is a balanced budget amendment important, and is it something that should be taking up any time at this moment in history, in your view, Mark Witte?
I think it's a terrible idea. I mean, I think the debt ceiling discussion is a waste of time, right? I mean, there are real crises that it would be wonderful if people in Washington were getting together to hash out, you know, how terrible we are in our PISA scores, international comparison of educational levels of, you know, K-12 students, or, you know, if there were like a greenhouse gas limit that, you know, we're approaching, we're going to figure out how to meet that, or if we're meeting to talk about, you know, the in excess of 4 million unemployed workers who should have jobs. But, you know, this debt thing is silly, and this balanced budget amendment, if only it only makes things worse by tying the hands of government to respond to crises.
Bob Janetsky.
No, I think the balanced budget amendment that's been kicking around is an excellent idea. I think it's one of the few ways that we would have of getting government spending under control. The problem in a democracy is that people end up wanting government to do a lot more than they're willing to pay for. And because of the way the system is set up, there is a tendency for people to get a lot more government than they really end up wanting, because the few people who want more programs are going to lobby for those programs very hard. It doesn't pay for the people who are going to pay for those programs to go
so
ahead
a
and
balance,
lobby.
So a balanced budget amendment would make it easier for politicians to say no to special interest groups.
Well, the balanced budget amendments that are kicking around are not just to balance the federal budget. They're also to limit government spending to a certain percentage of GDP, say 18%, unless there is a supermajority vote in Congress to get it further. And that kind of corrects what I believe is a major defect that has led to a much higher growth in government than most people would like
Mike
to
Miller,
see.
Miller, is this an important issue?
No, not in my mind. The other, just like Mark was saying, there's other things. He and I may not even agree, say, on the cap and trade or something, but these are the things we should be discussing. This is the matter. Medicare, the Social Security situation. What are we going to do? We cannot. This is not a pension program. This money. There's got to be. There's got to be something done with Social Security.
But just
not.
So a discussion. So a discussion of the balanced budget amendment. To pick up the term that's being used for the last month, that is the ultimate kicking the can down the road.
I just don't. I don't see that it's that useful. I do. You are correct, though, Bob, mentioning that government can only. If you look at this graph of no matter what the was true of the tax rates, the government almost never takes more than 18.5% of GDP. At one time, it went up to 20.1 during the Clinton administration. A fluke of a situation. I think that we should work with that number. That's fine, but I don't. I love the Constitution. I don't like amending it for things like this. I think it should be left to only very important things like women getting the vote or whatever. This is not the thing. The balanced budget amendment to me is not good government.
And 38 states would have to ratify it.
Yes.
It's just going to happen overnight. So
actually, this proposal, I think they're calling for 50 states to ratify, which I thought was incredibly bizarre.
Let's go to Chris in Palatine, Illinois, listening to us on our flagship station, WLS in Chicago. Go ahead.
Yes, gentlemen, good evening. I'm sure you'd agree with me that just like the expenditures made by, for highway construction by the federal government, Social Security payments are funded through a dedicated tax. So my question, gentlemen, is of the $14.2 trillion-odd in federal debt, how much of that has been caused by payments to Social Security recipients? And the answer to that, of course, is zero, because Social Security has a $2.3 trillion fund surplus, meaning we've collected $2.3 trillion more in revenue than we've spent out in expenditures. And if you know anything at all about fund accounting, that money should be dedicated strictly to those payments. And, in fact, Social Security is not going to be a problem for the next 23 years.
Let's let everyone respond. Everybody is raising their hand. They all want to respond to you. We're going to go to Mark Miller first.
That money's already been spent.
No, it has not.
It's spent. And the federal government says to the Social Security Administration, okay, you have more money than you need. You give me the money, and I'm going to spend it. I'm going to give you a non-negotiable bond in return. And when you need the money, you go ahead and give me that bond back. The money has been spent. You can only spend it one time. There is no lockbox. There is no money. There is simply a promise to pay.
What is important. What about all federal debt? When you buy a savings bond, when the Chinese buy a T-bond, when you buy any kind of federal debt, be it a treasury note, is that not the same thing?
No, it's not the same thing.
No.
Because it's negotiable. The stuff that the Social Security Administration holds is non-negotiable. It's a promise to pay. There's no money there. The money has already been spent. You cannot spend the same dollar twice.
But to butt in a moment here, that the Social Security Trust Fund, that's kind of a distraction.
It is.
Social Security is essentially funded by 12.4% or 12.6% of the first 100,000 or so of wages everybody gets. And going forward, Social Security is the best funded government program there is.
No, Social Security is bankrupt because there is no money there.
No, but I'm saying it is a dedicated tax source.
That's correct.
That in the long run, Social Security, it will always be there because it takes this huge chomp out of our wages.
It won't always be there, and the proof of that was President Obama saying we might not have the money to pay the checks.
Well, I'm glad that you take all Democratic politicians' statements as truth, but
that was over the top. Would you acknowledge that? That's way over the top.
I think that people should not take politicians' statements as true unless proven strongly otherwise.
No, Mark, we agree on that.
Yeah.
You are exactly right. There is a dedicated amount of tax money that does come in.
And it is essentially a pay-as-you-go program with this trivial trust fund.
We cannot put this – the government cannot save for the future. When I'm 57. When I retire at 66 or 70, whenever it happens to be, the populace of that day has to provide me the car and the food and the clothing. We cannot put food and clothing aside now for that future time.
Well, we can create
the economic growth necessary to provide me those funds when I want it. But there is no money there. I want you to keep in mind the dollars have already been spent.
Because the program is run by the government. in a private sector,
deny that.
And it would be possible to put those funds
see,
away.
The difference between my
government
403B
doesn't have
and what Social Security has is the bonds that I have in my 403B require someone else to perform to give me the money.
Yeah,
the Social Security lockbox requires the government itself to give itself the money.
Example,
and
you're absolutely right. And the example I like to give is I told my wife once that I'm going to establish $1 million retirement account for us. She said, great, where are you going to get the money? I said, I'm going to put $1 million in bonds into this account. She said, wonderful, where are the bonds going to come from? I said, the bonds are going to be something I issue. They're going to be my own IOUs. Now, what happens when I have to try and spend that? The same thing that the government does. They have to go out and borrow the money.
1-800-723-8029. More calls when we roll on from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont. From Skokie, Illinois to Seattle, Washington, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Let's head to Seattle. Pat is listening to us tonight on the Internet. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there, fellas.
Hello.
I have a question as to why the financial markets don't seem to be in agreement with the economics profession. They don't seem to be telling us, maybe the price of gold does, but not the stock market, that August 2nd is going to be a big deal. That maybe it's going to be like Carmageddon in Los Angeles.
Mark?
I think you hit the nail on the head there, that you look at the 10-year rate on government bonds, and you see very savvy investors looking long term, and they're like, "Yeah, there is no real problem. This is an artificial, it's artificial." You look at the OECD countries, and the U.S. is one of the lowest tax. We're way down at the bottom of the pack, and that, yeah, in the long run, we are good for this debt. The problem is going out beyond 10, 20, 30 years. The problem is, as Mike put it, the Medicaid explosion. Mm-hmm. That, you know, the number of people who will be under Medicaid and the cost per person. That's the long-run budget problem. Everything else is noise.
Mark? And the stock market is doing really well because of profits. Corporations haven't hired many people because the people working, if you look at the numbers for productivity, they're quite impressive. The people who are left are working their butts off to make sure they don't lose their job. So we have a situation where firms are making really good money. And, of course, the stock market then should go up. And so this is just one piece of a large puzzle in terms of the price of a stock is always dependent upon information. And information is a very broad concept. And this budget crisis, I think what it tells us is that the average person on Wall Street believes this budget deal will go through. There will be a rise in the budget, the limit for the government's borrowing. And I think the stock market has priced in that fact.
Yeah, there is, however, a potential for a disruptive act here. I mentioned earlier the situation where in early September of 2008, right before the bankruptcy started, hit mm-hmm. Lehman Brothers and everyone else, the decision was made by the Treasury that basically Fannie and Freddie preferred stock was going to be declared worthless. Mm-hmm. The banking system held $20 billion of that stock. Overnight, you took $20 billion out of the banking system, which supported $100 billion of loans and investments. That was the beginning of the financial crisis. And a lot of people looked around and said, you know, the government would never do that. This is before it happened. And the very smart financial people, because it would create an economic a crisis. It would be terrible. No one in their right mind would do that. Well, the government went ahead and did it. Now we're saying the same thing, and President Obama is saying, you know, well, I can't guarantee you we can pay the debt or Social Security. Mm-hmm. That would create a very serious crisis. As a matter of fact, if you just laid off all the government workers, even those who are non-essential, the shock to the system would be absolutely terrible.
That would be a shock is the whole point.
Okay, but my point is don't automatically assume that these guys are so smart that they're going to avoid all of these problems. The odds,
the
odds are still low, but they're rising.
Yeah. Mark, you said just a few moments ago, you know, corporations, companies, they're doing very well.
Yeah.
But they're doing well. They're making more profits. Fewer people are working harder.
That's yes.
So the concept that anyone who has more money or companies that have more money are going to expand and hire more people, that doesn't hold water.
Well, it does. Two things will happen. Firms will hire more people when more people come in the door and they buy. So there's a demand side to it. It doesn't make you a Keynesian to say that firms hire more just because they have customers. And another side to it is whether or not firms know the cost that they will have to pay to buy this worker. because corporations simply compare. They look at the ratio between what it costs them to hire and what they get from the worker that they do hire. Now, there's a lot of uncertainty regarding tax rates and Obamacare and so forth. That's only part of it. The other part is you have to have the people coming in the door.
Mark, pick this scenario up for a second, mm-hmm. because we've talked about how corporations are responding to the economy. Let's talk about how banks are responding, because the initial bailout of the banks, the assumption was that those banks were going to take capital and they were going to sprinkle the capital around and the economy was going to grow. Well, they didn't do that. So the question is, what are banks sitting on right now? And if banks loosened up a little bit, what would the impact on the economy be in your view?
Well, I'd follow Mike's point about lack of demand. There's a great article in today's New York Times by David Leonhardt about comparing spending on all sorts of goods with, you know, currently versus 2001, which is also a recession year, and how in a bigger economy, a larger population, we're spending less on all kinds of things, cars and, you know, appliances and things like that. And the magic number in investments in terms of like building factories and things like that is like 82%, the capacity utilization rate. And when the economy has a capacity utilization rate of its capital stock of less than 82%, there's just people don't build more stuff. The analogy I like is, you know, you ask your parents for a new toy and they say, "We don't play with the toys you've got." That why build another factory when there are vacant factories you could easily rent? And so, yeah, what are banks sitting on? They're sitting on lots of loaning ability, but they aren't getting like good people coming in, you know, business coming in saying, "Boy, we really want to expand," because you know, very few businesses can use all the capacity they've got now, that they just don't have the demand for it.
Yeah, there's also a mispricing of risk that has happened here. Before the crisis began, coming into 2007, they had mispriced risk on the side that they were giving loans to anybody for anything at any time,
mm-hmm.
and that was lunacy. And now we're in a situation where it's called counterparty risk, where you worry that the person on the other side of the exchange is going to fail, is going to not pay you back, and they have gotten to the point where they won't touch any risk. They've completely mispriced it on the other
right.
side. Now, when you add that to the fact that exactly, and that we households are saving more, we're trying to pay down our bills. This means we're not buying that extra couch or that extra car or whatever it is. All kinds of things have come which are going to have good long-term consequences. The economy will be stronger because we're saving more, but in the meantime, we're going to have this very high unemployment.
Mark, during the commercial break, you said that the economy as currently situated should have generated 4 million new jobs?
At least, yes.
Okay. Tell us why, because I know Bob disagrees with that.
Oh, he says it should be even more.
I think it should be 7 million. 7 million new jobs would take the unemployment rate of 4.5%.
All right. Walk us through the process of how those jobs are created in your view, given the current climate.
Well, it's something of a dog chasing its tail, that if I would buy more things, then there'd be more people working to make the things I would buy. And they would be there to buy the things I make. And so it's like a coordination problem. If we all start going and making stuff, we'll all have more income, and we can all buy more stuff. And there's a limit to that. You know, it's kind of like stacking up dominoes. You're trying to get them all standing up at once, but some are always falling down. Then a healthy economy, you usually end up with about 5% unemployment. You could, you know, we could get it less than that with, you know, better taxes and better policies and things like that. But, you know, right now we've got 9.2% unemployment, and it should easily be 5%, if not less.
Bob?
I think it should be less, but I think the reason is just totally off base. We do have a very strong sector of the economy, and that's the government. And it's not just the government spending. I wish our only problem was the government spending. The compliance costs on the private sector are absolutely astronomical. My latest estimate, before Graham, Dodd-Frank bill and before the health care bill, was that private companies are spending $1.7 trillion a year, and that's $700 billion more than they were 10 years ago, just to comply with government programs. Now, think about it. Whenever the government sets up another agency, whenever it tells businesses they have to do this, they have to do that, someone has to pay. Now, I agree with Mike. You look at the figures, the business hasn't been paying. Businesses don't pay. Businesses collect taxes.
That's right. They remit
only
taxes.
People
right.
pay taxes. And the
sure.
people who pay it are either the owners of the company or the customers or the employees of that company. What the businesses have done is said, with all this uncertainty, with what I estimate is $500 billion more a year in compliance costs because of Dodd-Frank and because of the health care legislation, they're saying, hey, we cannot afford this. And so we are going to cut back in every way, shape, or form we can.
Greg, driving near Terre Haute, Indiana, listening to us on WLS. Good evening. Nice to hear from you tonight.
Thanks for putting these gentlemen on. This is great listening.
Thank you.
I'm certainly nowhere in their caliber, but I did take some economics classes in high school and college, and I've run businesses and worked in corporate America. And Mike, a couple of years ago, a book called FDR's Folly, which an economist wrote analyzing the Roosevelt administration and their Keynesian model of how to solve the Depression. And using the figures that he analyzed, it only exacerbated it to the point that by 1939, Henry Morgenthau pretty much threw up his hands and said, this just isn't working. I don't see the Keynesian model ever working, because anything the government does to stimulate is only a temporary, therefore, Band-Aid process on what is a severe open wound. I think what you need to do is get off the backs of businesses through lower taxes, lowering their cost of doing business, cutting their labor costs where they can go out and hire more labor, which is a long-term, therefore, surgical application to closing up that wound. I just see government as almost screwing up anything they touch.
We got a bad cell. We're not cutting you off. Any comment on that, Mark?
I think there's a lot of evidence of government-led increases in demand and jobs. It's nicer if we can get it through, as we did under Clinton, where a rise in investment spending, is the tail that's wagging the dog.
Go ahead.
There is the government can have a role. I'm not one for big government. I'm a free market guy. But, Larry Summers, who worked for Obama, very, very bright man. And he, in the Financial Times some time back, he summarized so much of macro policy, that a policy should be timely. It should come in just when the recession begins. It should be targeted. It should be focused on where the money is needed. And it should be temporary. The government should get out of the way. And the one thing that, if I have any problem with this Keynesian idea of constantly stimulating, is that they don't know when to get out of the way. And that's the hard – I think that's where Bob would agree, that government's a large part of the problem. He kind of thinks that the government is the problem all the time.
Yep.
Kind of? Yeah.
Yep.
I think the government – for example, in this recession, there was one thing that the government did, which I think was very helpful for society, and that was income redistribution. We had a bunch of Americans who would have starved, literally starved, were it not for the transfers from the government.
We've got callers in Portland, Oregon, Boise, Idaho, Schaumburg, Illinois. Anybody new listening tonight for the very first time in Fresno, California, actually back on the air in Fresno, give us a call, 1-800-723-8289. From Texarkana, Texas to Boardman, Ohio, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8289. We have lots of callers on the line. Michael Miller is here. He's a PhD from DePaul University. He's an associate professor, and his training comes from Pittsburgh, University of Pittsburgh, and Slippery Rock College. He grew up in Pittsburgh. Mark Witte also joins us. He's a distinguished senior lecturer in economics, PhD, Northwestern University, and you've been there for 21 years, and Mike, you've been there for 31 years at DePaul University, so they must like what you're saying over there. Also joining us is Robert Janetsky, also an economist, author of the new book called Classical Economic Principles and the Wealth of Nations, available on Amazon.
Amazon, Barnes & Noble.
Barnes & Noble, and graduate of New York University, and also the University of Chicago Graduate School of Business, and also author of numerous books, including A Nation of Millionaires. That used to be a big deal.
Now they're
just thousandaires now. 1-800-723-8289. Lots of people on the call line right now. Let's head west to Portland, Oregon. Dorothy, listening to us on KCMD. Go ahead. Dorothy.
Hello. Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was wondering, since there may not be money for Social Security recipients, will there be the money for the payments for Medicaid and food stamps and welfare, all that stuff?
There's plenty of money. The government's taking in billions and hundreds of billions of dollars a month. It's just they have to decide which of these things they're going to spend on. There is money for Social Security. Remember, I'm paying 12-point-some percent into Social Security. So if you're retired, you're getting some of my money. So the money is coming in.
Thank you very
much.
Yes,
you're
welcome. No, I'm getting some of my money.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've been paying into Social Security.
You're collecting now, or are you paying in now?
I was paying in.
But it wasn't. But you see, there's no account for you. See, that's another misconception about Social Security. There's no private account with your name on it. You have No, there isn't.
Oh, yes, there is. I've been drawing Social Security.
Oh, you're drawing Social Security because the government's willing to send you a check out
of
a giant
pot. Nice.
But that's
not that sweetheart government. That's sweetheart Obama.
Actually, it was settled by a court case in the 1960s where somebody said, is Social Security a property right the same way my pension plan is? And the Supreme Court said no. So you don't actually have a right to that money. If a future government decided that Social Security was an anachronism and we're not going to have it anymore, they could get rid of it and it would be over. And you would have no right to anything.
I think Dorothy
They're not going to do that, by the way.
Dorothy, I think, is responding to the comments that the president has made when he raised the possibility that maybe Social Security checks will not go
out. And that's politics.
Out.
He's playing politics.
It is politics. Okay.
Absolutely.
So let me just say, folks, that's not change you can believe in.
That's correct.
That's not politics. Change you can believe in. That is business as usual.
Right.
And he wasn't going to do business as usual.
Keep in mind,
that's the ultimate abuse, I think. You know, either side. Republicans have done it as well.
Absolutely.
This is not a time when we need to scare the bejesus out of the American people.
I agree. And Mr. Obama was on the other side voting against everything when he was a senator. And now he's saying, I made a mistake.
Boise, Idaho is back on the spotlight. KBOI is the place. John's the caller. Go ahead. John, are you there? I guess John went out to enjoy the beautiful landscape out in Boise. Let's go to Harriet in Knoxville, Tennessee. Listening to us on WNOX, I understand she's not there as well. She's getting a cup of coffee. How about Santa Rosa, California? Bob is listening to us on XM Sirius Satellite Radio. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just wanted to comment on the fact that it seems like people don't want to tax the rich and they don't want to stop the outsourcing. That would cause our deficit problem to be solved.
So how much should – first of all, let me just ask you a couple of questions, and I'm going to let the economist respond because I know there's difference of opinion on taxes here. First of all, how would you define rich? When is someone rich?
Rich?
Yeah.
Rich would be that I don't have to work for a living, that I have everything I need and all I have to worry about is taxes.
Okay,
Bob,
Mike.
There's one distinction.
It's a low threshold for rich.
One distinction I want to make. There's a difference between what we in economics call income, which is called a flow variable, and wealth, which is a stock variable. You can have somebody, a grandma, who is very, very wealthy, who owns her own home, say worth $1 million, and has $1 million in the bank, but her income is only $25,000. So from the perspective, she has almost no income, but she's a very wealthy person. What we're talking about is not taxing wealth. We're talking about taxing income. So the question becomes, what is rich in terms of income? Ignore the fact that somebody may already have $1 million.
And the question becomes, wealth and income are the same to me because that's the living – they're spending money every year. They're not dead. So they're obviously spending some money on whatever they spend
on. But that would be sales tax. But you see,
how could only income count?
The number that seems to dominate now is $250,000. Now, for somebody who has already $10 million, that might be, you know, they might be rich. But what if you have somebody making $250,000 because they just came out of a medical school, and her husband is a police officer, and they make $250,000, $300,000.
That's not.
But
fair.
She owes $150,000 in college debt. Is that person rich?
So I don't expect somebody just out of medical school to be considered rich. Please.
No, his point is if they just came out of medical school, they probably have debt.
That's my whole point, is that you can't necessarily say that $250,000 is somebody who is rich. We have to make such a decision, though. And we've decided, apparently the president has decided, that $250,000 is rich.
Do we tax the rich too much, in your view, Bob?
Yes, I think we do.
Do we, Mark?
It's a political decision, and compared to all other sort of industrialized nations were on the low side. But we tax them the wrong way, is my guess.
How should they be taxed?
Well, ideally, we tax on a consumption basis. You shouldn't be taxing people earning income. You should be taxing people spending income. And we have to tax something. Mm-hmm. And you know, collecting it from the earning of income, the creation of wealth, the creation of products, that's a mistake. We should be taxing the spending of it.
Mike?
I'm of the philosophy that I would love to see a flat tax, but with all kinds of deductions wiped out. But I think if you take the current rate of 36-some percent for the rich people, mm-hmm. take the period 2007 where unemployment was 4.6%. We had a 1% or 2% deficit. We can do it. Now, if it went to 38, okay, a couple percent. There's no evidence that this is going to reduce revenues. We do know that tax increases, say, from 20 to 50 would do it, or from 50 to 20 would raise net revenues. We understand these things. But a couple percent here and there. But the idea that we can somehow take all this money from the rich because you're successful, I think, is morally bankrupt.
Well, Republicans argue that that if you tax the wealthy, they're not going to invest a lot.
Well,
they're going to save it. They're not going to use it as much as possible.
But we
so
don't
the
know.
Question is, what evidence do we have that rich people use their money more wisely than a middle class person?
Well, Bruce, I don't think that's necessarily the issue. First of all, I agree with Mark entirely. If we were to tax consumption instead of income and the creation of wealth, it would be far more efficient.
Just not
the
total.
Economy would behave much better.
I still want to follow up on the question. What do we know about who saves money more? Who saves and who spends it? If I'm making, let's say, $85,000 a year, and am I more likely to save the money that the extra money that I have, or am I going to spend
it? Okay, Mark and I would differ on this. My suggestion would be, if you're saving money, your move in saving that money is as productive as anyone else's move in spending the money. In fact, it may be more productive because you are providing some of the income that you have earned. You're not spending it on current consumption. You're making it available for someone else to spend. And so it doesn't matter. It's a myth that when I put money in the bank, I've somehow slowed down the economy, that I'm sitting on it. The money is not being sat on. The money is being used elsewhere. So we shouldn't look at whether someone saves or spends.
Yeah.
Each individual should decide on the basis of his own particular unique situation whether it's better for them to build up resources for the future and save or to go out and spend.
Mark,
we're sort of back to the Malthus versus Ricardo debate, and that in a healthy economy, you need enough spending to cover all the production. Otherwise, people stop producing. And the spending can come from consumption. It can come from investment. The problem is that people earn income. They save some of it. And if investment isn't there to take up all the saving, the economy falls apart.
And that was a mistake, what Mark just said, that Keynes made some years ago that has created enormous problems for us as an economy, because it has encouraged government to go out and get very active and try and spend when other people haven't spent. It's a flaw in the entire Keynesian analysis.
When you mentioned the responsibility of government, is it the responsibility of government to build and repair roads and build and repair schools, in your view, Bob?
The government should have some basic responsibilities, and the most important of those are to protect individuals and protect individuals from the harm that other individuals can do. They can expand and also
is building a highway or repairing a highway with potholes. Is that considered a safety issue, or is it a jobs issue? Because if jobs are being created to improve our infrastructure and to improve our schools, is that not both an investment and a job creations program?
Here's the critical thing: whenever the government spends money for your schools, for your highways, for whatever else, the government is taking money out of the private productive economy that everyone depends on, including government. Now, the more money it takes out, the more it potentially can weaken the private economy. If the government spends the money highly efficiently to build this road and increase productivity, then we're better off. If it spends it the way we have been spending it, we're a lot worse off. We're in the sort of trouble we're in right now.
More calls when we continue from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont. From Janesville, Wisconsin to Sugarland, Texas, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8229. Back to calls in just a moment. But Bob Janetsky, author of the book Classical Economic Principles and the Wealth of Nations, who is one of our guests this evening. Earlier in the broadcast, he talked about a website which is bipartisanpolicy.org. bipartisanpolicy.org. And if you're interested in trying your hand at balancing the budget, you can go in there. You can find out how much money is coming into the government, a month-by-month breakdown on the various line items and the departments. So if you want to cut the Department of Energy and you want to cut the Department of Commerce and the NEA and all these places, you can sort of add it up and see if you can come up with the you know, with balancing the budget. And by the way, how did you do? You didn't finish.
Well, first of all, I just worked on this August period here. We've got $172 million coming in, estimated to the government. Billion million. What's the difference?
One of the alien words. Yeah.
But then what you could do is you can see, you know, what would it cost to keep paying the soldiers, the interest on the debt, what does it cost to pay Social Security, and then it starts to get a little tricky from that point on. Just the paying of the military contractor bills was something like $31 billion. I didn't pay all of that. And I didn't pay people not to work. I mean, if you are in this dire situation where, you know, the economy is really on the edge and they can't come to an agreement, you've got to make some decisions like that. But the debt and Social Security are the first ones. We got plenty of money to pay for that. Medicare, Medicaid, I paid both.
But you wouldn't pay unemployment insurance.
You run out of money very quickly. I've also laid off.
So you're sending Social Security checks to wealthy people and screwing people who have no job.
You know, there aren't that many. There aren't that many. Well,
we're going to not vote you.
Is that a yes or no question?
Come on, Bob.
Are you sending the money to the wealthy Social Security recipients and screwing the people that are on unemployment?
I think with 1 month left to go, you don't have a chance to figure out who you think needs this money and who doesn't. You just get the checks out to that area. There's no way of distinguishing one from the other.
I want to talk about the speed with which certain things happen. Obviously, you shouldn't use the word, you know, speed when you're talking about anything related to government. But if Congress were to decide, okay, we're going to end the war in Afghanistan, we're going to end the war in Iraq, and we're going to end the war in Libya. We're going to end it all. How quickly would it take for the economic impact of that to be seen and felt by the American people?
Well, you know, I saw a study done on that looked at the amount of the GDP which was used to fight World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and so forth. And as we go through the wars, it just gets smaller and smaller. We're talking about fighting wars that cost us probably 1% of GDP, maybe 2 tops, in terms of the war itself. We still have to have a Department of Defense. We still have to have a military, even if those wars ended. The economic effect of this would be imperceptible.
Yeah. You agree with that, Mark?
Unfortunately, yes. Joe Stiglitz and a co-author whose name I'm unfortunately forgetting have looked at the costs, and they say there's a lot of long-run costs. The injuries and the pensions and things like
that's
that.
That's true.
But the cutoff right now would be small.
Okay. Yeah. Joe, that's a significant piece of news tonight. Joe in Schaumburg, Illinois. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Bruce. Hi, gentlemen. But getting back to the debt ceiling debate, as far as the grand bargain goes that the president wants, I don't think he's going to get it. But the other option that's out there that the Republicans don't like is the McConnell plan. Mm-hmm. The reason why they don't like that is they feel that Mitch McConnell basically is caving in to the president. But you know what, though? They're going to have to suck it up, the Republicans, because I think this is the one that's going to pass.
I guess they're calling it Plan B. The one thing it puts all of the onus on Obama's back, though. In other words, they're going to give him the increase, but he's the one that's going to have to make the cuts, and therefore when it comes time for election, they can say he cut it, not us.
Right, but the thing is, though, the Republicans, like I said, they're dead set against this plan for the simple reason because that, you know, McConnell's basically given in. But as far as I heard, I think Mitch McConnell, Harry Reid, and Joe Biden talk this weekend as far as that plan goes.
Yeah,
the president,
going on.
The president's not too keen on it, but he said at least it averts Armageddon. Yes.
Well, they are referring to it as the.
You guys think it's going to pass?
As the McConnell Reid plan.
You guys think it's going to pass?
I think yes. I think it will ultimately. Although most of the conservatives are saying that
they will not vote
for it. The conservative Republicans will not vote for it. So the question is, are there enough Democrats in the House to get it passed? It seems to me that, if it's something that gets the necessary votes, I think the Republican moderates, whatever you want to call them, establishment, they're going to have to suffer the wrath of the Tea Party Republicans, mm-hmm. and hope that by Election Day they will have their wounds will have been soothed.
Well, and since this is revenue related, I think it's not filibusterable. So. A simple supposedly, majority,
right.
supposedly.
Right. Right.
I think
simple
it's the majority.
Yeah, the problem, of course, Bruce, is it does nothing to change the trajectory that's out of control.
Let's get over
and
those,
it gives us it probably a downgrade of our debt and increases the expenditure on interest rates.
I don't think that's going to happen.
But it takes the ticking time bomb and that's throws right. it into the president's lap.
Basically, it's an abdication of duty to vote, to do absolutely nothing when you see this trajectory heading us into an abyss.
Well, that's what a majority leader should do. Let's go to and a minority leader. Let's go to John. Go ahead. You're on the air. You know what? You're not on the air. You're not on the air because the music isn't playing, and that means we are out of time. This 2 hours has just flown by.
Good God.
Gentlemen, you have been an absolute delightful group, even though we started on a bad point when I got my guest names wrong, but we're going
close.
To end it by getting them right. Mark Witte has been here, Director of Undergraduate Studies in the Department of Economics at Northwestern University for the last 21 years, a native of St. Louis, Missouri. Mark Miller, an Associate Professor of Economics at DePaul University. What did I say?
You said Mark. That's all right.
Mike Miller.
Yeah, here you go.
Mike Miller. You're 31 years at DePaul, and you are from Pittsburgh. And Robert Janetsky, you are from NYU and the University of Chicago, author of the book, The Most Important Thing Is Classical Economic Principles and the Wealth of Nations. And again, remember, bipartisanpolicy.org if you want to try your hand at balancing and cutting the deficit. Our thanks to Tom Vera Cruz and Sylvia Chavez and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in the production of this program, as well as Mark Glick. Until next week at the same time, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.